The next case on our calendar is 04394, State of Ohio, XRL, the Dispatch Printing Company versus Scott Johnson, Director, Ohio Department of Administrative Services. Mr. Little.
May it please this court, counsel, my name is Marion Little, and together with my partner, John Zeiger, we represent the Columbus Dispatch and one of its reporters, Alan Johnson. I'd like to reserve 6 minutes of rebuttal time today.
Watch your time.
This original action presents three different types of issues for the court today. One of them is the state's refusal to produce a number of residential addresses for us. The second is the state's tremendous delay in producing a number of addresses to us. And the third is the dispatch's prayer for an award of attorney's fees. We submit that each of these issues today can be resolved by applying this court's precedents, as well as the plain language of the Public Records Act, to those facts that are actually before the court. That is, this is not a case about creating new law. This is simply a case of looking at the record before the court and applying its precedents. The record before the court overwhelmingly supports the dispatch. And that is why the respondents in this case has tried to change this into something else by saying that what has happened over the last decade is a change in law. But there has not been a change in the law. Rather, there has been a change in the type of cases appearing before this court. In the 1970s, 1980s, and early 1990s, this court and the Court of Appeals of this state addressed on numerous occasions the public record status of state employee personnel records and the personal information of governmental employees. It did so in the context of resumes, applications, personnel files. It also did so in the context of payroll records. And indeed, this court also has previously addressed the public record status of residential addresses. What has changed, however, is the type of cases appearing before this court. In the late 1990s, we now have appearing before this court cases in which it is the personal information not of governmental employees, but members of the public. Individuals who have had their personal information collected and is somehow in the possession of the state, sometimes because they are serving jury duty, sometimes because they are participating in the activities made available by the city of Columbus, for example, in the case of pools. The case we are dealing with today is the former. It is not the latter. And in fact, in the McCleary case, this court was very careful to emphasize that there is a key distinction between the personal information of governmental employees and that of the members of the public at large. As to that case law dealing with the residential addresses, the applications, the resumes, none of that's changed. This court has routinely said that that type of information is, in fact, records. This court has routinely said that there is not a privacy test that is applied in deciding whether or not that information is available. This court has routinely said that there is not any form of balancing test available. In fact, this court has consistently said that information is public records. And in this particular case, the respondents have admitted all the hallmarks necessary for this court to make the same determination here. That is, the respondents in this case have admitted, when cross-examined, that the residential addresses at issue were in fact used by them as part of their daily activities, that they required each of the agencies to collect that information, that once the information was collected, that information had to be stored in a particular format. And then we have placed many examples before the court of the eventual uses for these residential addresses. So in terms of what has this court's precedent said in the past, and how does it apply to this particular case, it is all very consistent that the residential addresses are in fact records under the Public Records Act unless the respondents can establish that there is an exception that is applicable otherwise. Now, they have pointed to two different exceptions, and let me address the first. The first one is the Kallstrom exception. And we don't have any dispute that there is such an exception. The Sixth Circuit has told us so. This court has applied Kallstrom. But whether or not there is this exception in from an intellectual standpoint has nothing to do with this case. The question is whether the respondents have placed before this court any evidence to support that application. And the answer is they have not. A court afforded them ample opportunity to do so. Certainly the parties were permitted to take discovery. The parties were permitted to submit depositions before this court. The respondents were afforded the opportunity to submit affidavits. And what they submitted to this court does not pass muster. All they submitted to this court were cursory affidavits that included statistical information based upon their own secretive process, a process that they don't want to tell anyone else about, they didn't want us to take any discovery about, and they certainly just do not want this court to look at. And based upon those affidavits alone, the state of Ohio has taken the position that roughly 3,000 addresses should be withheld on the basis of Kallstrom. And I misstated that. It's actually a much higher number, 16,000. But this court has already taught us what the result is when a respondent who has the burden of proof fails to put admissible evidence before this court. That case is State X Rel Besser versus the Ohio State University.
In your view, the number that would qualify given is it based on the state's failure to put forth competent evidence would be zero under the Kallstrom test?
Based upon the record before the court today, the state has failed to prove its case as to a single employee.
On the Kallstrom test?
On Kallstrom. And under the Besser case, the court may remember that was a case involving the Ohio State University. There, the respondents had submitted to the court in camera the documents that were supposedly entitled to trade secret protection, and then the university in that case also submitted affidavits, cursory ones just like this. And there the court said, cursory affidavits don't pass muster with this court. You have not sustained your burden. The appropriate relief was for the mandamus to issue, and it did. There's not a different result here, given, again, the state's failure to put any admissible evidence before this court.
Mr. Little, do you agree that the statute that we should apply here in determining whether to grant the writ is 149.011G?
In terms of the definition
what's
of record?
What's a public record? What does the state have to give up as a public record? What information does the state have to provide?
That is certainly the court's first inquiry, whether or not the addresses themselves constitute records.
And the definition is served to document the organization, the functions, the policies, the decisions, the procedures, operations, or other activities of state agencies. How does a home address of a state employee meet that test?
A number of fronts, Your Honor. First, this court has already said that it does. Second, the respondents have already told us that it does. That is, it's not our testimony, it is their testimony.
Are we bound by what the respondent's conduct has been in applying the law?
Yes, it's a factual test. Whether or not
is it a waiver or I mean, somebody in the state agency has decided, well, we're going to give the relator here names that they want, and we're going to decide which ones they may have and which ones they may not have. Are we bound by that decision, or do we look to the statute to determine whether, now in the ultimate question, if you will, the request meets the test of the statute?
I would submit
we're writing law, I think, here for not just for this case, but for cases that may come after it.
I would disagree, Your Honor. I don't think we're creating any law in this particular case. I think we're simply applying the language of the statute to the facts that have been presented to the court.
Well, we'll write an opinion, I think, and the opinion will say this is what this provision, the statute, provides with respect to these records, and I would think other persons and agencies will take that statement of the application of the law to this case and use it to guide them in deciding what records they should reveal or make public in the future. Isn't that's what I mean by writing law. We're not, I agree, we're not, this isn't some new sophisticated legal issue before us. It's an application of the statute.
And I would submit that in this court's decision on this case that you'll first quote the language of subparagraph G, that you will then look to see what is the factual record before the court as to not only what has the state historically done in terms of releasing the same information to dispatch, but also in terms of what did the witnesses say in cross-examination as to what purposes and uses there were for the residential addresses. This court will look to see whether or not there was anyone at the state that admitted that this type of information was regularly used in their operations. And when the court looks for that in the record, you'll find the answer is yes. That's what they admitted in their depositions. The court will also look to see whether there is any evidence in the record as to a collection process by which this information was put together. And the court's going to find that and say yes. All that information was collected pursuant to a directive of the Department of Administrative Services. And the court's also going to ask the question, well, what ultimately did the state of Ohio do with this information once it was collected? Part of it was used to identify the employees, much like the Social Security card numbers that this court has found to be records under subparagraph G.
Could you go to what I think is the real question here? How does a home address of a state employee document the function of the office? State employee is home now. I mean, they reside someplace when they leave the office. How does their home address? Is there something here that the dispatch wants that isn't apparent? Or I guess I'm just trying to apply, as I always do, I try to apply the words of the statute to the facts.
Well, the language of the statute, Your Honor, is, as you know, very broad, construed in our favor. And the language speaks in terms of documenting the organization and activities, not just the activities as a result of what the government does, but the organization. And so the residential addresses provides insight on a number of things, not the least of which is how our public money is being spent, how are they distributed across the state in a global sense, but also on a more basic sense, the addresses simply authenticate and identify the employee, much like the name, much like the Social Security card number, and just like the address.
So someone's home address tells someone from the outside who wants to look at the organization of the Department of Insurance, let's say. Someone's home address tells them how the department's organized?
It tells them where the workforce, for example, is represented. That is, how are the state dollars spread across the state?
How does that affect the function or the organization itself? What's the relevance here to that information?
Well, I don't think that's the question. The question is not what is the relevance to the dispatch, for example.
No, not to the relevance to the dispatch. That's not our concern. The relevance to the documentation or the function or the organization. Whether John Smith lives in Franklin County or John Smith lives in Scioto or any of the other counties or what street he lives on, how does that serve the function of the Department of Public Safety?
It is no different than all of the other personal information that this court has viewed as being records for the last 20
years. Well, there's a difference between records and public records, so let's concentrate on public records.
That's right, and there's no difference between that and the other information on a personal basis this court has viewed as being records over the course of the last 20 years. That is, this is the same type of information, and your question could be put to resumes, it could be put to employment applications and payroll information. Your question would be appropriate as to all those categories. But if it was the perspective of others that type of information really does not document, and thus we take a position inconsistent with this court's jurisprudence, then the appropriate course of action is for some action to be taken before the General Assembly, not to create.
Well, the General Assembly has given us the parameters, and it is to document the operation of the organization, the function of the department, loosely speaking. Again, answer the question, how does someone's street address accomplish that purpose?
Again, it serves it in the function of identification. It serves it in the function of how the information is distributed to the employees. We've placed in the record the evidence of for what the uses are of the residential addresses. Those are the examples that I would cite for you. But your comment about what the General Assembly has done in terms of the parameters, I think, is significant here. Because if these documents, for example, were not records, if they were not public records, there would be no necessity for the General Assembly to make an exception for peace officers, for EMT workers, or for workers of children service agencies within the county. But the General Assembly has. The General Assembly has taken the position, we're going to carve out from the definition of public records the residential addresses of peace officers and other categories of employees. Implicit in that resolution is they had to be records to start off with. Because if they weren't, it's all an exercise of futility. And we must read the statutes so that they have a logical result. And there's also another statutory construction here that's applicable, that where this court since 1975 has found that these type of addresses are in fact public records, and that the General Assembly has taken no action to alter that result, it is presumed then that the General Assembly has adopted this court's construction. But again, it gets even better here. The better position is the General Assembly has affirmatively acted on this very subject. And when it made the decision, after balancing the various interests and the various stakes in play, the General Assembly said, we're going to only exempt out a certain category of addresses. We're not going to exempt them all out. And in fact, if residential addresses were not records, there would have been no necessity for those exemptions. There would have been no necessity for the Kallstrom decision. The Sixth Circuit could have simply said, that information's not a record. And there would have been no necessity for this court's decision in Keller, where it applied the Kallstrom analysis. The court could, at that point in time, simply said, they're not records. But that's not what has happened the last 6 or 7 years.
Counsel, how many home addresses were ultimately provided by the state?
Your Honor, that is difficult to answer because the information was provided to us, I believe, 2 days before the evidentiary cutoff, and was submitted to us in a form that was unreadable. I can tell you the numbers based upon their affidavits. They're a little bit shy of 19,000 that have been withheld. But what the number was that was actually produced, I can't tell you based upon the information that was provided to us. Let's take a moment and look at the second exception that has been invoked, and that is really the one for peace officers on 149.43b5. It's important to note that as to this exception, the state has not sought to protect any of these addresses on any other basis. That is, they did not invoke Kallstrom to protect the addresses under 149.43b5. So the entire issue is whether or not those addresses can avail themselves of that protection. The answer is that it is not. Granted, there is an exception for residential addresses of peace officers, but there is what I'll call an exception to the exception for members of the media. That is written plainly in the statute. That particular provision says that if the media submits a written request and provides some identifying information and certifies that the release of the information would be in the public interest, then that information is to be released. The state has conceded that each of those elements have been satisfied in this case. And so their only argument now is that the use of the term specified as found in the statute means that we can only ask for the individual address of one officer at a time. And that is simply an issue of statutory construction for this court to decide. If you simply take the language at face value, you'll see that the term specified only applies to the issue or answers the question as to which agency can release the information, not how many officers can have their addresses released at one time. I'll try to address the remaining issues in my 6 minutes of rebuttal, but I see that my time is up. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Little. Mr. Cannuti.
Good morning, Your Honors. I'm Randy Canuti, and I am representing all of the state respondents with the exception of the Department of Rehabilitation and Corrections and the Department of Mental Health. My colleague, Maria Armstrong, is representing those two departments, and Ron Snyder, on behalf of the Ohio Education Association, is here to discuss the issues of employees in general. This case raises both statutory and constitutional issues. I'd like to focus my comments on the constitutional. And in particular, I'd like to focus my comments on the constitutional issues that arise when we're dealing with state agencies, which are really nothing more than stakeholders in a battle between others. These state agencies are required to make, have been required to make determinations of constitutional dimension about some of the most intimate details of their employees' lives. And they've been required to do that without having any records to guide them. The state employees who have expressed fears of substantial risk of harm in the event that their addresses are revealed, those state employees typically fall into several distinct categories. They fall into the category of young women who have ended relationships and who have been stalked by their former partners in those relationships. There are a number of affidavits that demonstrate that category. They also fall into the category of individuals whose jobs in the state of Ohio involve so much contact with so much of a criminal element that risk is very clear. But from a constitutional perspective, I think the most important issue to decide here is the role of an agency that really is a stakeholder. And to assist the court in that analysis, I would like to focus on a previous decision in which I believe the court went through almost an identical analysis. And that decision was the 1994 case of Akron Beacon Journal versus the City of Akron. It concerned City of Akron employees' Social Security numbers. There were some 2,500 city employees whose Social Security numbers had been requested. And the court conducted a constitutional analysis in which it relied on the U.S. Supreme Court's informational privacy cases. Now, those informational privacy cases began with Whalen versus Roe and later with Nixon versus the Administrator of General Services. And I think they're very interesting because what they found, what they hold, is that everyone, all of us, we all have a constitutional level privacy interest in our personal information. Now, the degree to which a court will uphold that interest varies, but we all have that interest. As a matter of fact, in this court's decision in Beacon Journal versus City of Akron, it says this: the right to avoid disclosure of personal matters is so broad in scope that it applies to the most public of our public figures. Even the President of the United States possesses this right. That's this court discussing the Nixon and Whalen informational privacy issue. Now, as to the evidence, as to what was actually before the court in that case, where Social Security numbers were at issue, it was argued on one side that there wasn't enough evidence to decide the matter. That would be the same argument that the relators are making here. But the evidence that actually proved crucial was considerably more limited than the evidence that you have before you right now. In that case, I believe only one employee of the City of Akron actually testified. That one employee testified that he had been the victim of an identity theft some 5 years earlier. One employee out of 2,500 actually testified. But the court found, nonetheless, that all 2,500 employees had a legitimate, real expectation of privacy. And it was interesting how the court came to that conclusion. It came to that conclusion by looking at statutes and evidence outside the record. It came to that conclusion by looking at the Federal Privacy Act of 1974, and based on that act, determining that everyone should have a legitimate expectation of privacy in personal information. Now, once it's determined that there is this legitimate expectation, what happens next? What happens next, under any kind of a constitutional analysis, is that that interest has to be weighed against the public's interest in disseminating the information. And I'd like to bear in mind here that we're not really talking just about state employees' home addresses. That's not the precise issue that we're really concerned about. We're concerned about the linkage between a home address and a state employee's name. In other words, the fact that Jane Smith lives at 123 Elm Street may be of very little significance, but the fact that Jane Smith, the same Jane Smith, who is a corrections officer, who perhaps has incurred the wrath of a now-released inmate, the fact that that Jane Smith lives at 123 Elm Street is something worth a great deal more protection. Now, in the City of Akron case, as to weighing these competing interests, the court found that, based solely on other case law, the court found that the theft of a Social Security number or the misuse of a Social Security number of any employee, hypothetically, could result in, I believe the term was, ruinous harm. Again, that determination was made without a factual record other than one employee's testimony. Now, having determined that there was this significant risk, or at least risk of a constitutional level in the disclosure of a Social Security number.
Do you want us to analogize the home address to a Social Security number? Is that what you're asking?
I think in the circumstances of this case, that's entirely appropriate. Now, every single one of these state departments and agencies has produced addresses. So the state agencies, acting as a stakeholder, truly have already attempted some sort of a constitutional balancing. I think it would be appropriate to make the analogy. And as a matter of fact, I might point the court to the Federal Freedom of Information Act. In the City of Akron case, this court looked at the Federal Privacy Act to find an interest in the privacy of Social Security numbers. I would suggest that perhaps the federal FOIA is the place to look to find a similar interest in the privacy of home addresses. That statute actually does exempt home addresses. Having reached a determination, however, of the weight, if you will, of the interest of some employees in nondisclosure, the next step, of course, is the obvious one. It's to weigh the interest of the public, not of the dispatch, but of the public, in the dissemination of that information. Now, in the City of Akron case, the court found that there was essentially no interest of the public, or no meaningful interest of the public, in employees' Social Security numbers. And the court reached that conclusion because those numbers, standing alone, mean little or nothing about the workings of government. Now, I would also point out that
I believe in the Akron case, the Beacon Journal was arguing it facilitates our research. It's an easy way to index all of these other things that we are interested in.
That's correct.
That's the reason they, in particular, wanted it. It was just an easy way to electronically collate a lot of other information.
That is correct, Your Honor, and it's very much similar to the argument that is made here. I think the argument, as I understood it, was that the dispatch benefits by having a very sophisticated intranet, which will in some way assist it in news gathering.
Counsel, before you get to the balancing, I want to back up. Do you know how many addresses were ultimately, in other words, as you indicate, the stakeholder agencies at some point in this process decided to release home addresses for a number of employees. What was the total out of the total number of state employees that exist?
Your Honor, I believe that there is a total number of state employees of something in the vicinity of 65,000. I believe approximately 3,000 or a bit less addresses were withheld as being those of peace officers, EMTs, or firefighters, and the remainder would have been the CalSTRM or constitutional withholdings.
So how many were provided then?
Provided would have been, I believe, 45,000 or a bit more.
Right.
In addition, of course, the dispatch has received a whole host of information documenting the salaries of state employees, their positions, and essentially almost everything that appears on a W-2 form.
One other question in this regard before we get to balancing. Does DAS or any other agency who has these home addresses cataloged electronically, do they provide that willingly to anyone?
There is some evidence suggesting that, at least in the past, various home addresses have been provided by contract to unions and perhaps other benevolent associations.
What about health insurers? It seems to be my mailbox is full of solicitations from...
As is my own, especially at this time of
yes.
year. That is correct.
So it's furnished willingly to all of these private industry folks who are soliciting business for health insurance purposes.
I think the category the number of groups that have been given that information is rather small.
And is there a contract that requires them to use it only for the purpose of for that purpose and not to sell or make available or in,
yes,
to,
Your
to,
Honor.
To keep it confidential other than that internal use?
Yes, Your Honor. As I understand it, there are confidentiality clauses in those contracts. But I would like to address the bigger issue, the waiver issue, if you will.
I know you're going well beyond the time that you requested, if you want to leave time for two co-counsel.
I'm sorry, Your Honor. If there are no further questions, I would like to have Ms. Armstrong address the statutory issues.
Okay. Thank you, Mr. Kennedy. Ms. Armstrong.
Thank you. May it please the Court, the Department of Rehabilitation and Corrections and Ohio Department of Mental Health are happy to be here today and appreciate the opportunity to address the Court about the very important issues here. If I may deviate a bit from my presentation and just pick up where Mr. Kennedy left off, the prior release of home addresses, be it pursuant to collective bargaining agreement or pursuant to a contract between the Department of Administrative Services, certainly doesn't act as a waiver and certainly doesn't limit this Court in its application of the law to the facts of this case. This Court is very free to look at the statutes and the Constitution presented before it to the facts that are apparent in this case and fashion a rule of law. And we would respectfully ask the Court to do exactly that.
Ms. Armstrong, if I understand the argument of Mr. Little, his position is that 149.011G documents a public record, including the home address. And his point is that there's no exception for home addresses, and the legislature has further exempted certain categories of home addresses, and it doesn't include state employees. And then there would be no necessity for CalSTRM if, in fact, this statute didn't include home addresses. Could you respond to that line of argument?
Certainly, Your Honor. And we respectfully disagree with that argument. This Court has consistently laid out a two-part test for public agencies when they're reviewing whether or not a particular document is a record and is a public record. The first part of that analysis is, do we have a record? Does the document before us constitute a record under 149.011G? In this case, we submit that it does not. The home addresses of the employees on the facts of the record before this case do nothing to document the functions of the state agencies, do little to shed light on the internal workings of those agencies. In this situation...
If you accept that argument, why was there the necessity of specifically exempting police officer, firefighters, et cetera, if, in fact, that's what the legislature intended?
We submit that based on the facts before this Court and this record, home addresses are not a record. Certainly, there may be instances where home addresses may document the functions of a state agency or a public agency. We submit that that's not before the court here today.
But then why, again, getting back to my question, why would the legislature need to specifically list those categories if all home employee addresses were not public records?
I think that the listing of the legislature is telling in this case. They were specifically reacting to issues before this court. They added a laundry list of what were examples of private information, including social security numbers, including medical information, which it was very clear long before the legislature drafted that section, were not public records. That section was undertaken, in our opinion, by the General Assembly as an exception to the rule. It does not signify that the General Assembly specifically considered or addressed home addresses of all state employees. They were looking at a very narrow category of peace officers, firefighters, EMTs, and presented a laundry list of information that was not a public record or was an exception to the public records law.
Counsel, would you agree that there are some circumstances in the course of state government where home addresses may be a public record? For example, if an individual has a residency requirement in order to hold the position that they hold or employed as, if they would be using a state vehicle, for example, with permission to transport from their home to their office or in a general geographical area, would you agree that at that point there may be some relevance for home addresses to the function of that particular agency?
Certainly, and we are not advocating here for a blanket exception to all home addresses. In the instances that you mentioned, certainly that is the case. But those types of instances aren't reflected in the records requested here. There's nothing in a payroll database that tells you that that employee is parking their car at their home driveway. There's nothing in that payroll database, as voluminous as it was, that tells you that that employee is assigned to work out of their home. There are other documents that may tell that function, and that's why this court's consistent application. First, you look at the document. Is it a public record? Does it document the functions of the internal workings of the office? In that type
of definition, though, counsel, also includes the procedures of the office, does it not? You talk about an agency communicating with its employees, the procedures, the payroll procedures. I mean, if we look at the definition under G, the definition is very broad, seems to include home addresses of which the General Assembly has exempted certain express home addresses, being that of police officers. I mean, isn't that the way we have to read the statute?
We would advocate for a narrower reading. The procedures of the office in this case are that an employee is paid, what they're paid, what their benefits are, not where their check is delivered. On a rare occasion, an employee who may be on disability is mailed a check. The record is clear on that. But the fact that that check was mailed to their home really doesn't document about what's going on with the taxpayers' dollars or what's going on in the internal workings of the agency. Much more relevant is all the information that was revealed, and that is that the employee was paid and how much they were paid and what their benefits were. We would also like to stress today on behalf of—
Just so you know, you're using part of Mr. Snyder's 2 minutes.
Okay. Appreciate the court's time. Thank you.
Thank you, Ms. Armstrong. Mr. Snyder.
Thank you. May it please the court, counsel. My name is Ronald Snyder, along with my partner, Bob Sauter. I represent the Ohio Education Association, which is one of the intervening parties in this case. As you're probably aware, the Ohio Education Association represents something like 130,000 plus members across the state, members who are educators and work in the public schools and various other institutions throughout the state. Also intervening in this case, as you know, was the Ohio Civil Service Employees Association, who according to their brief represents something like 36,000 employees throughout the state. The decision here today will impact not only those 166,000 plus employees, but clearly will have an impact on every public employee, or a potential impact on every public employee throughout the state and in every county of the state. We agree with the assertions made by the Department of Rehabilitation and Corrections and the other responding defendants who have asserted that these are not public records because they are not records within the meaning of Section 149.011 of the revised code. And we also agree with the assertion that there is, for each of these employees, a very significant right of privacy, which must be balanced against the interest in the disclosure of that information. One point I would like to make regarding the question of the analogy between the Social Security numbers and the addresses, I would agree that the Social Security number is analogous in that it is personal information. I don't think the analogy carries over to the point that addresses, home addresses, would document the functions of an agency in the same way that a Social Security number might need to document the functions of that agency. With regard to the question of the privacy interest, I think it's important to note that a large number of the individuals involved in this particular case that are represented by the Ohio Education Association work in the Department of Rehabilitation and Corrections and the Department of Youth Services, where they deal on a daily basis, as the evidence in this case indicates, in close contact with inmates who are often violent criminals and have a propensity to violence and making threats. These individuals are actually trained not to share any personal information with inmates. They can actually be disciplined if they do so. And yet, if these are public records, then those individuals upon release or their relatives, friends, or associates can get that information upon request.
Wouldn't it be better, counsel, then to work with the General Assembly in getting an exemption to the public records section, as peace officers have?
Your Honor, our view would be that under the existing law, as the statute is written, there isn't a need for that type of legislation because we don't believe these are records which document that, and we do believe it is clear that there is a privacy interest which exists which precludes the release of that type of information under these circumstances.
So you would say that the constitutional interest trumps the statutory language the way it is now?
Well, I would say the constitutional right of privacy would trump a statutory requirement to the contrary, yes.
Thank you, Mr. Snyder.
Thank you, Your Honor.
Mr. Little, you saved a little more than 30 seconds of your time.
The state's position has remained consistent, which is they don't think they have an obligation to submit any evidence to this court. They stood in front of you again today and said, we know that there's a test out there. The test is a substantial risk of bodily harm, possibly even death from a perceived likely threat. That's the Kallstrom test. And yet they stand before you today and say, we don't have an obligation to prove that, to put any evidence before this court to support that type of position. The answer is that they do. This court's precedent is clear that they have the obligation, and the record is very clear that they have failed in that obligation. Thank you.
Thank you. The case is submitted. You'll be advised of our opinion.